What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. Thank you so much for joining. We are so excited to be here with you tonight, and we have a great show. We have two guests who have never been on the show before, so we're very excited about that historic moment. Before we start, though, I want to, of course, remind everyone to give this stream a thumbs up, give it a like. Also, if you haven't already subscribed, please do subscribe by hitting subscribe and then pressing the bell. Also, if you can become Patreon supporters, please do that at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And yeah, this show is really special. So we have two segments. During the first segment, we're going to be talking to Ben Cohen and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. During the second segment, we're going to be talking to return guest Jose Luis Granado Ceja about Mexico, Venezuela, El Salvador, and immigration. So I'm going to introduce our first two guests and then bring them on. And you probably have heard of them. Let's see. We're going to start off with Lawrence Wilkerson, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He's an anti-war critic of U.S. foreign policy and a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, as well as the Eisenhower Media Institute. And we're also bringing onto the show Ben Cohen, who is an activist, businessman, philanthropist, and co-founder of Ben & Jerry. So welcome, Colonel and Ben.
All right. Good to be here.
How are you, Katie?
Thanks for joining. I feel like, if I'm calling Lawrence a colonel, should I call you like Ice Cream Man?
Yeah, you can call me Cone. Right.
He's
Colonel
and
I'm Cone. All right.
Oh, yeah.
Cone and the Colonel.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. Cone. Yeah. Wow. So I want to start off just by asking both of you what your thoughts are on the Trump administration so far. As people know, Trump presented himself as a man of peace and non-interventionist and anti-interventionist who's going to drain the swamp. And of course, Elon Musk was going to join and has joined, and he was going to cut waste. So what are your thoughts on this presentation versus reality?
More and more of it is turning into a lot of bullshit, I think. You've heard so much about Doge and all these cuts that he's making. The reality is that 50% of the discretionary budget is the Pentagon. The Pentagon is the biggest waster, the biggest spender, the most corrupt department. And what he's doing is he's cutting these departments that represent these small slivers of the discretionary budget pie. And it's becoming, I think, more and more clear that he's kind of doing these grandstanding events saying, oh, there's this horrible waste here. There's this ridiculous expenditure there. But he's just fiddling around the edges. He's just using so-called drive for efficiency as an excuse to essentially get rid of departments that are serving the needs that people actually have. And he's exempting the biggest waster the most inefficient department in the federal government, the only one that can't be audited. And so that's what's happening. It's not about efficiency. It's not about eliminating waste. It's about grandstanding, about some little itsy bitsy parts of the federal government.
Right. And what about you, Colonel? What are your thoughts on this?
I agree with just about everything being said. And let me take the other side of it then. Let me just make one comment on DOGE and Elon Musk. It appears to me, and I've been a Republican for 50 years.
Plus, okay, this is a safe space.
It appears to me that he's doing everything some of my party have wanted to do for a long time, and it has nothing to do with government efficiency and everything to do with Republican desires. Dick Cheney did a lot of that, for example, when he was vice president, when I served Colin Powell as chief of staff. The other side of your question, though, is the one that troubles me the most. Domestic issues do trouble me, though. And that is, look at Pete Hegseth today, yesterday, whenever it was, when he's talking about Al-Ansar, the Houthis, and he's talking about Iran. This is a peacemaker? This is a president who's not going to get us into another war? This is a president who is going to do exactly the opposite of what Joe Biden and Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan and Lloyd Austin did? I think not, if you're talking like Petey Hegseth was talking today. I mean, that was a direct shot at Iran, and it was a very ignorant shot, too. It shows that Hegseth has not done his research, his reading. He doesn't know anything. This is a country that is ages old. It was once the most powerful empire in the world. It's had a long history. It's got 90 million people, too, and some really indomitable terrain. And we're going to put it back as a nation in the international community. How funny is that? They're looking at us as a state in that community, and they're saying, we signed an agreement with you. We signed an agreement with you, Russia, China, the UN Permanent Council, Germany. We signed an agreement, and you backed out of it. To us, that agreement had the force of international treaty. We don't care if your Senate didn't ratify it. It had the force of a treaty, and you backed out of it. You're going to bring us back into the world? We're not sure we want to come into your world. Very, very amateurish approach, and it bespeaks an administration that's more warlike even than the previous one.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty depressing, I think. And it's, you know, it shows, I think, how persuaded people are by words and by Trump's promises, even though he's, you know, quick to break them. And I think that maybe people had hopes that it would be, it's understandable given how kind of belligerent Joe Biden was, that people, I think, were hoping for a less belligerent alternative. But I think, as you guys have both laying out, I mean, that is not what we have. And I always think that, you know, the true test of whether people actually care about waste, and I'm not so, I don't believe in like slashing funding or spending anyway, but you know that someone's lying when they don't go after one of the biggest bloated institutions in the world, which is the Pentagon.
Yes, absolutely. Ben's perfectly correct there. And we're talking about almost $1 trillion now. And with the Congress and people like Wicker and others doing what they're doing, the Pentagon doesn't even ask for the amount that the Congress then pluses it up. And they're doing very dangerous things, too. Recently, for example, they took some repair and maintenance money out of the Virginia-class submarine, which is really old, and put it into modernization and, you know, fancy blue ribbon things. I hope they reverse that. I hope someone in the Senate reverses that, because that's people's lives. Not only is that one of our main security instruments, the submarine, but it's also people's lives who are on those submarines. If they're not met, they're old. They're really old. The new ones are way over cost, way beyond schedule, typical. And so we're risking the lives of those men and women on the boats. That's not what we should be doing.
Yeah, I know that both of you talk about and care about the issue of nuclear weapons. And in the middle of February, Trump shocked the world by saying there's no reason for us to be building brand new nuclear weapons. We already have so many. But is he actually denuclearizing? from what we can see?
I haven't seen any evidence of it. He said two things. I mean, one, he said we can cut the Pentagon budget by 50%. He's not doing anything like that. And the other was that he was going to talk with the other nuclear nations about reducing nuclear armaments. And nothing like that is happening. The country currently has the equivalent of 50,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs, the explosive force of 50,000 Hiroshimas. And the country is planning on now building a whole new generation of nuclear weapons at a cost of $2 trillion. And I'm not aware of him doing anything to stop that.
Well, this is the aspect of Trump that I like the most, if there's anyone that I did like the most. But I agree with Ben. I haven't seen any progress on it. And of course, the progress is being impeded, I think, by you need a relationship with Moscow and you need to end the Ukraine conflict in order to have that relationship. But he talked about 50% on both sides and then bringing Xi Jinping in from China, who is embarked now on a build out of his complex because he's seen America. He's seen its modernization program, $2-3 trillion over the next 10 or 15 years. And you know, the cost overruns will be $4-5 trillion. And he's seen Russia maintain 5,000 to 6,000 warheads. So he thinks he's got to build out, because Mao's theory in the beginning was, I don't want any more nuclear weapons than I need to deter others. So China never had more than 300 or 400 nuclear weapons. Well, they're going to build out to match us now. So we're going to make the world a heck of a lot more dangerous if we do that. And I think Ben's right here. I don't know if he knows this, but I think what we're doing right now with some of this planning for modernization of our stockpile is to build weapons that give us a first strike capability. That's a first. No one should want to do that. And I'm really puzzled why we have not denounced first strike as an option for us. We've been that way for a long time. We won't do it, but we should do it. We should set an example for the world that way, and certainly for the 9 nuclear weapon states, 8 besides us. But we won't do it. And now I'm being told we're trying to build out to where we could strike first and win. That is to say, yeah, the accuracy of our weapons, the throw weight of our weapons, the MIRV warheads of our weapons will be so new and so technologically sophisticated that they'll be invulnerable in flight. There'll be no fratricide. They'll all hit. They'll all kill. They'll all destroy. And we can ride out whatever comes back at us, because we will have destroyed the majority of the enemy's weapons. That is truly insane.
And actually, I wanted to go back to that Hexit video that you brought up, Colonel. Let's take a look at this. It's from Fox News.
Of course.
It's a great honor for me to have the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, here. I've known him for a while. My family's known him for a while. He's a man of enormous integrity, smart as hell, and I can sleep at night knowing he's the Secretary of Defense. Mr. Secretary, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mark. So great to see you.
Let's jump right in with Iran. Iran is a grave threat to the United States. They're trying to build intercontinental ballistic missiles. They want to have nuclear warheads. President Trump has made clear in his first term, in his campaign, and now, as have you, as has the Secretary of State, as has the National Security Advisor, you're not getting a nuclear weapon by hook or by crook. It's best now that you have a chat with us. Other administrations have had chats with them, too, and they basically have done the rope-a-dope stuff. How confident are you are that, number one, they're going to want to talk, and number two, that it can actually lead to something concrete?
Well, Mark, it has to, and that's what President Trump is committed to. He has said very clearly, as you stated unambiguously, Iran will not get a nuclear bomb under a Trump administration. Unacceptable, full stop. Very clear. He said it. He'll keep saying it. Now, as we see with Vladimir Putin and Zelensky, there's only one man on the planet. And this is true. This is not hyperbole. One man on the planet who could bring them to the table and forge a lasting peace. And he's doing that right now. We're in the process of doing that. That is unique to Donald Trump, because he's strategically unpredictable. He's strong. He's clear. And he's respected. on the world stage. I think the same is true in Iran. We know the double talk of the Ayatollahs. You know it. You lay it out. I understand it. There have been secret, duplicitous moves for years and years and years. But we are at a moment under this administration where President Trump is giving them an offer. He is saying, now is your chance to come to the table and completely give up and dismantle your program. Let's talk. I'd prefer to talk rather than do anything else. At the same time, he is ensuring that at the Defense Department and across our military, we maintain all capabilities necessary to work with our partners to, if we have to, and we don't want to, but if we have to, prevent Iran from gaining nuclear capabilities. So he's clear. The position is clear. Iran understands their options. There's never been a more serious leader atop the United States of America. There's a very serious leader atop the state of Israel. There's a clear message that Iran cannot get a nuclear bomb, and we are prepared to enforce it. But we would much prefer that it be done at the table for the betterment of the Iranian people and for the betterment of peace. So we hope that's a possibility, but we understand the complication.
Okay, a lot to unpack there.
I think he's coloring his hair with gray now to make himself look a little more distinguished.
Yeah.
Did you hear that statement? There's never been a more serious president in charge of America. Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I could think of a few. And gross ignorance of Iran. Just gross ignorance. He's not done any study of Iran at all. As I said before, we added JCPOA. We are a state in the state system of the world. Our system, we say, rules-based order and all that stuff, we had an agreement. Iran looked at it as a state agreement, state to state, and we had lots of buy-in. We had the Chinese, we had the Russians, we had the UN Security Council and the Germans. And Trump executed, terminated that agreement.
Right.
What would you think if you were Iran? This is the most duplicitous superpower I've ever run into. I don't know if I even want to do an agreement with them again. And to say that they're going to bring Iran back into the world again, dear Petey, Iran has 1,000 years plus of history. It was once the greatest empire in the world. You're going to bring them back into the nation statehood of the globe? It's just total ignorance. And I think the whole approach to Iran is wrong. That said, I think that's what Trump wants. I don't think he wants a war. I think he wants a Nobel Peace Prize. And he sees that he can outdo Obama and Biden, and he could get a deal and then push it all over the world as Trump's deal. Look what I did. No moratorium on it. No 25-year moratorium. I talked about ballistic missiles with them and other things, and they couldn't do that in the previous administration that conducted a deal, the JCPOA. But I've got the deal. I've got the deal of the century. That's me. Give me the Nobel Peace Prize. So I think there is a prospect here that Iran might just hold its nose, enter the negotiations, and we might have a deal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really it's quite embarrassing that this is someone who's supposed to be representing the United States. I mean, it tracks. The thing about Donald Trump is he kind of is the perfect face of empire because he's so masks off about everything. And he's such an ugly face. I mean, I'm not talking about his appearance. That's another issue. But he's the perfect ugly face of empire because he doesn't hide anything. But I'm not sure of
how much. Being strategically unpredictable.
Yeah, what is that?
Colin Powell would say that's the worst thing America can be, is strategically unpredictable. Worst thing for our friends, worst thing for neutrals, worst thing for our enemies, to be strategically unpredictable. We need to be strategically predictable. We are probably the only power in the world that needs to be strategically predictable. He's thinking about New York real estate. He's thinking about, and I listen to Witkoff. Witkoff, mild-mannered man, makes great statements. Otherwise, I'd say, okay, this is a gentle head. This is a good head. This is a well-spoken, well-mannered head. And yet he just exudes an ignorance of both Russia and Iran. And I don't know where you go with that kind of ignorance, because you're not dealing with ignorance on the other side.
And he's definitely lying when it comes to Hamas, as we know.
Well, that's a different matter altogether. That turns me off completely with Trump, just completely.
Yeah. What are your guys' thoughts on Trump's, you know, on the quote unquote ceasefire that wasn't really a ceasefire? What do you think Trump wants when it comes to Israel and Palestine? And then this question, I always like asking this question of guests because people have such different perspectives on this. But is it that, and I think I know what you would say, at least Colonel, is it the, when it comes to the wagging the dog, is it Israel that is using the United States or the United States that is using Israel, or is it both? And what are they using each other, or which, whichever one is using the other one using it for? Ooh, that's a mouthful.
Get it, Ben.
I'm supposed to figure out what's going on there. You know, it's a genocide, and Biden was fine with that. And Trump seems to be more than fine with that, which is horrible. I mean, it's horrible for Israel. I'm a Jew, and I think it's the worst thing that Israel ever could have done in terms of its own security and its own place in the world. It seems to me that Israel is kind of using the United States to do its dirty work. I mean, I can't believe that my country is the country that's enabling this genocide. And I get the feeling that it's just all about money. You know, AIPAC is essentially financing Congress, and they do whatever AIPAC says to do. And, you know, doing things for money, that sounds very Trumpian. He's focused on money, I think. I think in general, you know, the U.S. has this policy that it wants to control the world. And I imagine that it sees Israel as its outpost in that part of the world. But, you know, Larry knows a lot more about this stuff than I do. So I turn it over to him.
I'm not sure anyone knows. It's a mystery to me, the relationship. Sometimes I think they're leading us. Other times I think we're using them. Most of the time, the latter, because I think we're trying to create an arc of instability all the way from the Baltic down to Chabahar and Bandar Abbas at the southern end of the Persian Gulf, because we think that arc of instability will somehow gather our allies to us, particularly European, and Trump has sort of defied that a bit, and we'll have a better perspective on and a better mountaintop, if you will, to fight from if we have to fight Russia and China, let alone Russia and China together. That seems to me why we did Ukraine in the first place. Reestablish our hegemony over Europe, that's failed majorly. And at the same time, bleed Russia, and at the same time, get Europe ready for the war with China. You have a NATO Secretary General who said, Jens Stoltenberg, when he first took over, NATO's a defensive alliance. And then the next sentence was, and now we need to turn to China. How do you call NATO a defensive alliance and then turn to China? But that's what the U.S. wanted.
Unless they're defending China, which they're obviously not. Yeah.
And what Israel's doing baffles me now. Esther Solomon, the editor of the English version of Haaretz, the oldest newspaper in Israel, wrote one about 3 days ago, and she said, Bibi Netanyahu is waging war on three things. Israel's democracy, Jews from Europe who are more liberal than others. He doesn't want them to come anymore. He wants Ben Gavir and Smotrich's only. And three, Gaza and the Palestinians. And now Syria. He's killing people in Syria now with both his air force and his ground forces. That he's doing for us, that's the way I read it. He's widening the war for us because we want that instability. We tried to get rid of Bashar al-Assad for 25 years. Before that, we tried to get rid of his father. We tried to mess Syria up badly, and we did with our sanctions. And now why haven't we lifted them? Well, we haven't lifted them because we still want Syria to be a basket case. And Israel is happy to go in there and weave the basket. And that's what they're doing now. I wouldn't be surprised if they, if Netanyahu stays in there, if they start doing it with respect to Jordan and maybe even portions of Egypt. So I think Esther is right. He's destroyed Israeli democracy. He wants to get more and more people immigrating to Israel who are like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, right-wingers par excellence. And he wants to destroy his enemies wherever he finds them. And if they happen to be Jordanian or Egyptian or Syrian, he's going to do that too. I think he's bitten off far more than he can chew. And I think we're looking at a debacle there very soon.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of the genocide that Israel is perpetuating, a very great group that is always outspoken on this issue is Code Pink. And just today, they, Code Pink, including the amazing another former colonel, Anne Wright, interrupted a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. And let's watch what happens and let's see what they are accused of being by the great Senator Tom Cotton.
Anne is fearless.
I know. She's great. We've had her on a bunch and we always love having her on. She really is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Witness will suspend.
The greatest threat to global security is Israel, and the whole world knows it. Stop funding Israel! Stop funding Israel! Stop funding Israel! Stop funding Israel!
So that protester was a Code Pink lunatic saying the greatest threat to world peace is funding Israel. I will observe for the benefit of the audience here on television that Code Pink is funded by Communist China as well, which simply illustrates, speak up now if you want to be removed as well, whoever's saying that.
So that's Anne Wright, who was at the State Department, was a diplomat, a colonel, and as she pointed out, had a hip replacement, and they are shoving her out just for merely opening her mouth and speaking the truth, calling for an end of genocide, and also just correcting the record in terms of the smear from Tom Cotton. Now let's listen to what Medea Benjamin has to say, who, of course, is one of the founders of Code Pink.
After Tulsi Gabbard spoke, Tagbari got up to say that Israel is the greatest threat to global security. As he was pulled out, Senator Tom Cotton, who is in charge of the hearing, said that that person was Code Pink, and he mentioned Israel because Code Pink is funded by the Chinese Communist Party. That is such slander. That is such lies. Of course, we get zero from the Communist Party. We don't even know anybody in the Chinese Communist Party. And we don't need any outside force to tell us that what the U.S. is doing in supporting Israel's genocide is horrific. And that's why he stood up. And that's why Anne Wright stood up and got arrested to say, stop slandering Code Pink and start looking at what Israel is doing. The genocide is something that we can't keep supporting enough.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that you have to have a foreign power like bribing you or encouraging you to protest a genocide that's being live streamed and supported by our government, armed by our government, defended and legitimized by our government is just so laughable. And whenever someone says something like this, all I can think is, oh, well, he's projecting. Tom Cotton's projecting because he has no soul or moral conscience or moral compass. But yeah, what are your thoughts on both what Code Pink is demanding and the way that people respond to these demands?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the idea of soul. And I think that the U.S. Supporting this genocide is essentially trampling on the soul of America. I think that, you know, I grew up thinking that you know, America stood for justice and equality and fairness, and that it was defending human rights. And what's happening now, what we're seeing exposed in Israel in supporting that genocide, is that the U.S. is trampling human rights. I mean, we're deliberately killing people. I mean, it's not a war, it's a slaughter. And I don't think there's much difference between somebody getting killed by a bomb or getting killed by being thrown in a gas chamber. I mean, this is ethnic cleansing, and it makes me as an American feel horrible. And I think that, you know, we talk about what does America stand for. I mean, what can you say? You can't say it stands for justice and peace and human rights. You got to say it stands for ethnic cleansing. It stands for slaughtering innocent people. That hurts.
Yeah.
D'accord, mon ami. Let me say this. Tom Cotton and people like him are the Joe McCarthys of our age and the Joe McCarthys of the Republican Party. And that interesting that they come from there most often. Here is the wording of the 28th or 58th session of the HRC, the UN HRC, yesterday in their report. Starts this way. This is the title, quote, "More than a human can bear, : Israel's systematic use of sexual, reproductive, and other forms of gender-based violence since October the 7th, 2023. This is the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. And that report I read, it is horrible. It is absolutely horrible. And that doesn't even talk directly about the genocide, the killing. We keep seeing 50,000, 40,000. Ralph Nader is probably closer to the truth. It's somewhere upwards of 200,000 people. 150,000 of them are under that rubble. It's in Hamas's interest not to report the total numbers because the Palestinians are getting angry with Hamas. Today, the anger reached a crescendo around the Nazarene corridor. 200,000 people, 50% of which are children and women. These are not terrorists. These are not people who are toting a rifle. These are not people who are threatening Israel. These are people Israel wishes to expunge from the face of the earth. And apparently Donald Trump is perfectly willing to go along with that, as Joe Biden wants. And I agree with Ben. This is unconscionable. And I cannot believe that the country I spent 31 years in uniform for is doing this. It's a disgrace.
You look at them targeting journalists in Palestine. It's an admission. We are doing horrible things. Right. We don't want anybody to know about it. We're really pissed at these guys that are letting the public know about what we're doing.
Yes.
If freedom of speech, you know, we don't have freedom of speech here in the U.S. anymore. And so, you know, we don't allow freedom of the press in Palestine. It's
right.
It's about keeping ugly things secret.
Right.
That's the reason they kicked Al Jazeera out. They were telling the truth as best as they could find it. My next door neighbor is an Al Jazeera staffer. And I get some interesting stories.
Yeah. The way that they are targeting journalists is absolutely despicable and disgusting. They killed two the other day. One of them was Hossam Shabbat, who left a just heartbreaking kind of last will and testament where he said, if you're reading this, it's because I've been killed. And he went on to say that it was an honor to basically die defending his people. Just absolutely awful. Totally unforgivable. We know also that one of the directors of the film No Other Land was kidnapped and beaten and handcuffed while he was being beaten. And again, this is the irony, is that this is someone who won an Academy Award. Like, this is a relatively high profile person. And if this is the way they treat someone who won an Academy Award, I mean, he'd probably be dead 6 feet under by now if he hadn't been involved in a film that won an Academy Award. I mean, the impunity is just stunning. And like every time you think it couldn't get worse, the impunity couldn't get any worse, it gets worse. But I do want to take a listen to this testimony that you just referred to, Colonel, about the UN Human Rights Council documenting the abuse of prisoners. So let's take a listen. Because for some reason, our media, which always talked about the alleged mass rape committed by Hamas, for some reason, when it comes to the documented rape committed by Israelis of Palestinians, they don't mention it. But let's take a look at this testimony.
Taken to Sidat Iman, and she was nude searched over and over again and filmed. And then she was raped twice by Israeli male soldiers, two of them at a time, while videotaping her. We have also one testimony of a woman who was also taken. She was also, she says she was also raped by an inspection device by a female soldier more than once. They inserted the inspection device in her rectum. We have also one testimony of a woman saying that she was strip searched and they would beat her on her behind and they would humiliate her in front of each other. Most of the women also who were taken from Gaza, West Bank and Jerusalem said they were beaten on their genitals, which has made us, you know, to conclude that there must have been a directive that's been given to the Israeli army to treat women in such manner, because in Jerusalem you're treated by a completely different law enforcement than in Gaza or in the West Bank. But all these women said they were beaten on their genitals.
And I could just add on about the women who were forcibly disappeared in Gaza. Like I said before, it was usually as they were fleeing south through the safety corridor, they were abducted at the checkpoint. Many were taken to the Zikim detention center and the Negev detention center, and all together in one large hall, forced to strip completely naked and just sit in this hall, the women with the amongst each other and the men amongst each other. And it's also been reported and known that Israeli civilians are invited to come to this detention center and mock the Palestinian prisoners while they're naked, photograph them, and watch them as if it's a zoo. So that's something that we've seen.
Also, when it comes to checkpoints, like I said, it's where the sexual violence happens and it goes unreported. So we have a testimony of a teenage girl who was made to undress a man because he refused to undress. They made her undress him, even though she's not related to him. She doesn't know who that man is. And while being searched and touched and molested on their breast and on their genitals as well.
So horrific, and not something you'll ever hear reported on by Western media.
No, you'll find all manner of reporting in the New York Times, for example, on what Hamas did, but you'll find almost nothing on. And by the way, this isn't something that's new with Israelis. And by the way, Jeffrey Goldberg, he of the titillating story of the day, Jeffrey Goldberg was an IDF member and a prison guard in Israel, wrote a book about it. Israel's prisons are known for this kind of behavior and this kind of treatment of Palestinians for more than two decades. It's really bad.
Yeah, I mean, the dehumanization is so pervasive. And I mean, to add insult to injury, no political leaders or media elites thinks it's even worthy of comment or coverage.
You have to demonize your enemy if you're going to kill them the way they're killing them. I mean, you have to treat them subhuman.
Right.
There's no other way to do it. That's the same thing we did with the Apaches, the Comanches, the Sioux and others. Wounded Knee, all the places where we broke our treaties and did the ethnic cleansing in the most significant and profound ways, they were all Indians. They were all red people. They weren't human. They were subhuman.
Yeah, it's infuriating. Lastly, because I know you guys have to go, and thank you so much for your time. You've been so generous, and I would love to have you back because this is such a fascinating, important discussion. It's just so important, I think, to have people who have been part of the army reveal these things, you know, make the points that you're making. It's different from when someone like me does it, you know, like someone from the Upper West Side of New York City who went to a socialist summer camp. It's a little different, lands a little differently. But what are your thoughts on this scandal, which in my opinion, the scandal is how this is being reported on. But as people know, Jeffrey Goldberg, who you just mentioned, who is at The Atlantic, he, in a recent Signal thread between Pete Hegseth and others about war plans in Yemen, which is kind of an unusual place for top secret chats, A person was mistakenly added to the chat, and this has caused quite a stir. And that person was Jeffrey Goldberg, former IDF soldier and prison guard, as well as the editor of The Atlantic. And according to Goldberg, these war plans against Yemen and Ansar Allah were sent to him by accident. And we actually have some of the screenshots that were sent. So I'm curious what you think of this story. And let's take a look, Brad. We have that article, I think, in the Newsweek, or we can just show that one to start with. Oh, you've actually, okay, here we go. Signal war plans chat, read leaked texts in full. So let's take a look at some of these texts. Okay, so J.D. Vance. Pete Hegseth, if you think we should do it, let's go. And this is, they're talking about bombing Yemen. I just hate bailing Europe out again. Let's just make sure our messaging is right here, is tight here. And if there are things we can do up front to minimize risk to Saudi oil facilities, we should do it. Pete Hegseth, VP, I fully share your loathing of European freeloading. It's pathetic. But Mike Waltz, Mike is correct. We are the only ones on the planet on our side of the ledger who can do this. Nobody else even close. Question is timing. I feel like now is as good time as any, given POTUS directive to reopen shipping lanes. I think we should go, but POTUS still retains 24 hours of decision space. Okay, here we go. This is great. Oh, yeah. And this is tweeted out by Michael Tracy. So Michael Tracy tweets, celebrating the initiation of another open-ended U.S. bombing campaign with American flag and fire emojis is really touching. So a good start. And then Mike Waltz does the fist emoji, the American flag, and the fire emoji, which, I mean, could be interpreted as, you know, America is a dumpster fire, but I don't think that's what he meant. Then we have someone saying, good job, Pete, and your team. Then Michael Waltz, the team in Mal did a great job as well. Great work, all powerful start.
I think MAR might be Marco Rubio.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
And just a quick question, Colonel Wilkerson. Correct me if I'm wrong, but would this, technically speaking, be them violating the Espionage Act?
Well, John Kiriakou passed an email around here recently saying that he was convicted under three parts of the Espionage Act for the very same thing that is happening here, and of course he went to prison. You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, but it's not going to happen. You hear Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, dismissing everything, just dismiss everything as if there was no problem whatsoever. Now, let me say something about other data that was released. One of the things that is most dangerous to release to the public or to do in any way violate the security that should surround it. And let's disabuse ourselves of this idea that operational data is not supposed to be classified. That's hogwash. It's the highest classification in the land. It's classified by soldiers and sailors and airmen's blood. So you go out there and you leak this information, and then something does happen because you leaked it and you get people killed. Now, unfortunately, that didn't happen here. But it very well could have if it got out into the domain where other people could have done something about it. Like, for example, set up air defense systems that were along the line of attack and such. That's probably not within the capacity of the Houthis. So they knew that they were operating against an enemy that probably wouldn't be able to take advantage of it. I fault Goldberg here, too. Goldberg sat on it once he figured out it wasn't a hoax. He at first thought it was a hoax. He sat on it because he knew he could make journalistic riches out of it. He should have picked up the phone and called his buddy, Doug Feith's son, who's an NSC staff member. And he and Jeffrey, I understand, communicate with one another periodically. And he should have said, you need to get the Waltz and tell him this data is out there. They need to postpone. They need to change the date and time or whatever, because this risks troops' lives. Nothing used to irritate Colin Powell when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff more than people letting operational data out. That's the ultimate goal. You don't want your troops to be in danger because you leaked information putting them in that danger. And that's the potential here. And they're dismissing it as if it were nothing. Now, think about this. If Johnson were of the other party, if Hegseth were of the other party, if this small group was a Democratic group, Johnson would be leaping from the podium in the House. Special committees, we're going to investigate this. We're going to put all these people in jail and everything. But it's his people that did it this time. Now, the Democrats are the same way. They would have been the same way. But this is nonsense when it comes to troop safety. It just shouldn't happen. And the idea that it's not classified because it isn't stamped with top secret code word on it is just poppycock.
And of course, there's another scandal here, right? Which is that we're bombing Yemen.
Yes. We've been at war with these poor people for almost two decades now, helping the Saudis, the Emirates, and others, and we haven't beat them yet. That ought to tell us something. That ought to tell us something. They've got insurers not willing to insure shipping. They've got shippers not willing to ship in a place that's more important than the Persian Gulf. About 50 to 60% of the commerce in the world passes up through that area. We had a tabletop at the U.S. Institute of Peace recently closed down by Donald Trump. Incidentally, that tabletop was sponsored by Central Command and Africa Command. We had the military all over the Peace Institute, and we were talking about this area of the world, the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea and all the commerce through there. Now it's pretty much stopped because of al-Ansar, the Houthis. That's incredible. They are some kind of valiant fighters. You just got to take your hat off to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're totally demonized and vilified as these terrorists and murderers. When how many people have we killed in Yemen? We being the United States Army, the military.
Yes. We and the Saudis and the Emirates.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
I mean, it's disgusting.
It's disgusting, really. It truly is. And I got to say this for them. They have said they've been very explicit. Stop the genocide, let humanitarian assistance get in, and we won't do a thing. And they did stop during the ceasefire. They started up only again when Netanyahu started up again.
Right.
They've been very explicit about that.
Yeah, again, like incredibly moral position.
The only Arabs with a set of cojones.
Okay. Yeah, to find out how to say that in Arabic.
I wish I did.
Yeah.
I wish I did.
If anyone in the chat knows, let us know. Well, I know that you have to run, Colonel Wilkerson. You have another appearance. Thank you so much for doing this. Ben, I do have a question for you. It's a little bit less serious than these other questions. So I wanted to share with you my favorite ice cream flavor from Ben and Jerry's. Okay, ready?
Please do.
Chubby Hubby. Now, the thing about Chubby Hubby is that I never would have thought if someone had said to me, do you want to have some ice cream that is vanilla malt ice cream with peanutty fudge covered pretzels with fudge and peanut buttery swirls? I wouldn't think that that would be one of my, let's say, top five favorite Ben and Jerry's. But what really impresses me is that it's called Chubby Hubby and it still sells so well. So was there like any pushback from marketing being like, this isn't going to sell well? You don't want Chubby in an ice cream title. Ice cream flavor title.
That was actually a flavor that was suggested by some customers. You know, I was actually at a speaking at some college, and these two women came up to me and said, "Hey, you know, I have a husband who is really, really into your ice cream, and he prides himself on knowing everything about it." So we thought we'd play a trick on them, and what we did was we came up with this container that looked, you know, that kind of looks like a Ben & Jerry's container, and they called it Chubby Hubby, and they came up with this flavor. You know, it's interesting that this was one of the first sweet and salty flavors, you know, that got to be kind of hip, and it's one of my favorite flavors.
Yeah.
And you know, that it has vanilla malt as a base. I mean, that's like kind of like an old flavor. You don't find vanilla malt around these days. I mean, you can barely find a malted, you know, you can't get it. it's all shakes, so to speak.
Right.
And that was, so these women came up with the concept, and, I brought it to life, and I used that vanilla malt base, and came out great.
Wow! Well, thank you.
You got my mouth watering.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite flavor, Colonel Wilkerson?
Well, he brought it up to an event we had in New York. I like that. What do you call it, Ben? The one you brought up to New York? Do you remember?
I don't know. I don't remember which one.
Oh, my favorite ice cream is vanilla. This was like vanilla, but it had a little bit of swirl in it.
Mm.
Uh-huh. This was maybe vanilla caramel fudge or something
that
like that.
That might have been it. It was delicious. He brought tons of ice cream up to our event in New York City.
I want to make
that. It's hard for the ice cream man to show up empty handed.
Right. Yeah.
It's interesting that Chubby Hubby was a suggestion. Cherry Garcia was a suggestion. Oh, wow. And Chunky Monkey was a suggestion. These are another all from customers, and they all begin with CH.
Oh,
I don't
that
know
is
what
interesting.
It is.
Wow. Wow. Another one of my favorites is the mint chocolate cookie one. So good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a hazelnut one that's so not hazelnut. Sorry. What's it called? Heath Bar Crunch one.
Yeah.
If I may say, I think the Heath Bar Crunch one is much better than the Toffee Crunch one, in my opinion.
Yeah. What? So, Heath Bar Crunch doesn't exist anymore. I don't remember there was a reason why. I think Heath wouldn't get kosher. We were trying to make our ice cream kosher Jews.
Wow. So, oh my god, as if there's not enough anti-Semitism in the world, now we're going to get blamed for canceling one of the best places.
Because of them, that we don't have Heath Bar Crunch anymore.
That is a shanda.
My late wife used to be really partial to one of your sorbets, or I forget what it was called. It was kind of purplish. But it was very good.
Yeah. That might have been a Doonesbury flavor. It was
very good. She got me to eat it one time, and I started liking it.
Yeah, and then the company goes and discontinues it. And I think that's irresponsible.
Yeah.
I mean, getting people addicted to a flavor and then just cutting them off cold turkey.
Yeah, seriously.
It ain't right.
Yeah.
But you know, there is the flavor graveyard at the Ben and Jerry's factory in Waterbury, Vermont. You can go up and mourn for your departed flavor.
Wow. At least that's possible. Wow. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. This is really great. And I did end on a lighter note, but I think we talked about some really important things, obviously. And I really am so grateful for both of you and the work that you do. And of course, you are one of the founders of the Eisenhower Media Network, and Colonel, you are one of the speakers there, members of it, right? So, and that's great. And we've had on Matthew Ho, for instance. So it's great. It's a great, really great resource.
Another great guy.
Yeah. Wonderful. Any final words from you guys before you leave? And if not, don't worry, no pressure, because I'd love to have you back on.
Just a pleasure being with you, and always great to be on with Larry, because he knows this stuff.
Yeah.
My final words are, I hope we last for the next three plus years.
Oh, yeah. That would be good. Yeah. Fingers crossed. Well, thank you both so much.
Take care.
Thanks. You too. Bye. Have a great night. Okay. That was great. Really enjoyed talking to both of them. Next time we have to do a live event over some ice cream. I forgot to mention that it was really cool. I went to a birthday party for Pete Seeger. And Ben sent a bunch of ice cream for the great Pete Seeger, the late Pete Seeger's birthday party up in Hudson. So, guys, if you haven't already given the show a like, please give it a like, give it a thumbs up. And we're going to bring on our next guest. And I'm so excited to bring him on. I've had him on before, but I never get enough time with him. So we're going to have a one-on-one with him. And he is the great Jose Luis Granado Ceja. He is the host of the Soberanía podcast and YouTube show. He is also a writer and photojournalist. He's based in Mexico City, and he previously worked as a staff writer for Telesur. So we are going to bring on Jose Luis. Welcome.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Wow.
Although I caught the end of that last segment, and now I want ice cream.
I know. What do you have a favorite flavor, either Ben and Jerry's or more
generally?
We don't
get the same variety here in Mexico. We do get it. It is available. Right. It's a little hard to find, but of what's available here, I'd probably say chocolate chip cookie dough.
Have either of you ever had fish food?
Oh yeah.
Nope.
Another good one. No, you never had it? Oh yeah,
it's
good. Yeah.
Next time I'm in the US, maybe I'll try one of these kind of rarer flavors.
Yeah, you should. Yeah.
If they let me into the country, because it's not looking like people who are critical of US foreign policy are being let in right now.
Right. Nope. In fact, they're often being kicked out.
Yeah.
If they're
I don't mind being deported, but I really don't want to be jailed for weeks at end.
Right. Yeah, deporting isn't bad, right? Because then you get a free flight home.
Yeah. One, it would make a story, right? I've always said if it ever happens, I would write about it.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah. They do have a churros flavor. I can't remember what it is.
How do we not have that here?
That's a lane for you. There you go.
We'll have to talk to Ben.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So welcome back to the show. And you're really such a perfect person to talk about all the this news with, because you are based in Mexico City, but you also are very well-versed in kind of Latin American issues writ large, also Venezuela, El Salvador, and immigration. So I want to actually start off, though, by reading a tweet from you that brings everything together, kind of a perfect segue from our last segment to this segment. So you commented last week on an interview with Rubio. What Rubio said, first of all, it's wrong to think about it as we're bombing Yemen. We're bombing the Houthis, and they happen to be located in Yemen. And you responded with a tweet that I found fascinating. And you wrote, this is how they'll talk about bombing Mexico, too. Just replace Houthis with cartels and Yemen with Mexico. In either case, it's absurd. So can you elaborate on what you were talking about here? Do you think that bombing Mexico fits into Trump's vision, perhaps? Or how does Mexico fit into Trump's vision of this newfound or renewed manifest destiny scheme?
Yeah, when you hear Rubio say things like that, it's an insult to our intelligence, thinking that somehow that's an acceptable kind of discourse. And yeah, the reason that was my first instinct, I'm like, I'm certain that if it actually came to pass, it's something I've been warning about for a while now. I think Trump and the people around him are pretty serious about this. There's a lot of people inside of his cabinet that we can call Mexico hawks, who are kind of fighting to have more influence, to be able to carry out military actions unilaterally inside of a Mexican territory, all in the name of combating cartels. And it's quite similar to the sort of justifications that they try to sell when it comes to attacks against the Houthis in Yemen, or, you know, the Venezuelan migrants, trying to associate them, all of them, with Tren del Agua, trying to criminalize all migrants and all asylum seekers. And so, like I said, it's an insult to our intelligence, but certainly within the Trump cabinet, I think there's really kind of two camps. Oddly enough, Rubio is kind of on the more moderate side of things, who is kind of right in his analysis when it seems that he's worried that if the U.S. does take unilateral action inside of Mexico in the name of attacking cartels and, you know, bringing down the level of fentanyl that's arriving in the United States, it's going to ruin the bilateral relationship, and it's actually going to affect them over the long term, making it so these kind of cooperation on security, which there actually is extensive cooperation between Mexico and the United States, would come to an end. And I think rightfully so. Of course, Mexico would see this, borderline on act of war, a violation of our sovereignty. You know, Mexico is one of those countries that, even in the best of times, is very suspicious of the U.S. and U.S. imperialism. And certainly given Trump and all of his behavior, his tariff rates and all the rest of it, there's just a heightened mood here, a nationalistic mood, certainly an anti-imperialist mood here in the country. So yeah, that would end cooperation agreements. And then there's these Mexico hawks, right, who want to see military action. They think that the military is the solution to everything. I think, you know, they've really drank the Kool-Aid when it comes to the ability of the U.S. armed forces to solve everything in the world. I think they watch too much Hollywood. I mean, when you have somebody like Hegseth, who is woefully underqualified as the Secretary of Defense in charge of these kinds of decisions, well, you know, he's the kind of guy who probably believes the narrative coming out of Hollywood that the U.S. is going to come and solve everything. And that is the, you know, the magic bullet, the magic solution to everything. But it is very, very dangerous. And I do think that if they do win, and I think there are signs that this more aggressive side of the cabinet of the Trump administration is winning out, I can get to that in a minute, this is how they would tell us. They would try to convince the world. And you can see how it does have an effect on certain parts of the U.S. population, unfortunately, right? You have a lot of people who are already talking about Mexico being responsible for the invasion of fentanyl into their communities. I mean, I think it's a very regrettable thing. I really do emphasize, I'm not saying this kind of out of like a political discourse, right? I'm worried about the working class people who are living with addictions inside the United States. Many of them who got hooked onto opiates because of the pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, we know that whole history and, you know, blaming Mexico. I always like to remind people when this comes up that, you know, actually the fentanyl and its derivatives, its precursors, all the rest of it actually didn't even come from Mexico up until 2019. It came directly from China. And then China kind of cracked down on its exports. And so because the demand was still there, it started kind of passing through Mexico, because these organized crime groups inside of Mexico obviously see the demand and want to fulfill it because it makes them rich. And that's the story of it, right? And so I do think, like I said, that there are some signs that some of this more aggressive camp is winning. But also credit to President Claudia Sheinbaum, who has been very astute in her negotiations and kind of getting Trump to back off and see the importance of cooperation, see the importance of the economic relationship that does exist in North America. So we'll see what plays out. But I don't have very high expectations. Their treatment of migrants really shows us just exactly what the Trump administration is capable and willing to go to, including flouting their own laws and their own constitution.
Yeah. And why is it, by the way, you know, a lot of people have commented on this, that, you know, Biden lost, a lot of people lost recently in elections that were kind of justifiably described as anti-incumbency elections. And then you have Claudia Sheinbaum, who obviously was not president before, but her party was, and she was the kind of, you know, she was the mentee, or I don't, that sounds too, that's too condescending or too.
I think it'd be fair to call her protege, the protege of.
Protege, thank you, yeah, thank you. Protege of AMLO. Why was she able to win? And it looks like she's very popular. How was she able to remain so popular, given that the kind of Mexican powers that be and international powers that be are so vehemently against her?
Yeah, I think this whole narrative personally around the anti-incumbency trend is just them trying to console themselves from the fact that they had bad governments, bad policies, and terrible campaigns. And I think that's particularly true in the United States. You know, I read a couple articles about precisely this phenomenon. What is it that about Mexico? And I think it really boils down to the fact that as soon as López Obrador came into office, there was really kind of a radical shift in terms of the welfare policies in this country. Previously, it was very much kind of, you know, merit-based assessments, kind of a lot of bureaucracy, obviously a lot of programs that were kind of clientelistic in the sense that they were aimed at garnering support for this or that political party. And what López Obrador did was come in and bring in universal social programs. So the most popular one being a pension for seniors. So anybody 65 years and up would get a bi-monthly payment, which wasn't an extraordinary amount of money, but in a country like Mexico, particularly in 2018, that was, you know, with rampant poverty, was a life-changing amount of money, but also dramatically raising the minimum wage, rising more than 100% in real terms, policies that were aimed at redistributing the country's resource wealth, you know, these social programs, you know, it's not a one-to-one relationship, but basically all of the money that comes in from the state oil company, for example, which was rescued under López Obrador. It was on track to being privatized, basically being torn apart from the inside. He brought it back under national control, gave it priority, kind of dug it out of a debt hole. It brings in enough money to basically pay for all of the social programs. So it shows that, you know, there can be a remaking of the neoliberal state. And that's what López Obrador did. And basically, Claudia Sheinbaum ran on a campaign saying, I'm going to continue and also deepen what we call here in Mexico, the fourth transformation. So she talked about expanding the social programs and immediately upon taking office did so. What she did was bring it over to women who basically by the end of her term, or actually by the end of a couple of years, they've accelerated the timeline. Women who are 60 and up will be eligible for this universal pension, more scholarships for students. Again, so these kinds of products, in continuing to increase the minimum wage, these working class centric policies, that's the difference, right? And people felt that difference. They saw that material improvement in their lives, and they saw on the ballot the choice between going back to the neoliberal era, then these kinds of policies that they were familiar with, or to continue with this kind of post-neoliberal economic model. And one of the more interesting things I think that Claudia has been doing is precisely the emphasis that she's put on state intervention, on saying that the state isn't just there to regulate, but actually needs to play an active part in the economy. And that's actually given her a really good negotiating position with the United States, with this whole tariff threat. You know, it's twice now that we've been on the brink of the tariffs being imposed on Mexico, and she's managed to negotiate out of them. But also knowing that on the one hand, Mexico's economy obviously would be impacted, but she has the confidence that, you know, there's a more robust national economy, a stronger working class base, more people who are in the formal economy versus the informal economy than before. All these kinds of factors that even if the tariffs are imposed, Mexico will be okay. You know, she always points to, for example, the pandemic, which was a huge economic blow here in Mexico. I mean, big portion of, I don't know the figure off the top of my head, is based on tourism. And that basically froze overnight. And Mexico endured, right? At a cost. I mean, we have to remember there was a lot of lives lost, like there was throughout the world, but that really showed that it can. And of course, the mass amount of support. So right during the second time that Trump was about to impose these tariffs, she announced that she was going to call for a public demonstration here in the capital of Mexico City, in the Zócalo, to announce her response. She's like, what my strategy, my plan B is going to be a public response. And so I want to invite everybody to hear it. In the interim, she ended up negotiating a deal. And so, you know, the event was turned into a festival, she said. And I actually had the expectation, given that sort of the urgency of the situation had passed, that the turnout was going to be moderate. It was overwhelming. More people showed up on that day to defend Mexican sovereignty and to show the president that they had that support than they did on the 100 days rally that was held, her first 100 days in office, which was so full that, like, even the Zócalo, which people who are familiar with Mexico City, it's this massive square. It's one of the largest in the world. It wasn't big enough to hold more than, there's 300,000 approximately on the 100 days, and there was close to 400,000 on this day to defend Mexico, and on an explicit basis to say, I mean, I was there obviously, and people with banners saying, we defend the president, we defend our sovereignty, don't mess with us, this kind of language, right? That's really extraordinary. Even in my wildest dreams did I expect that Claudia Sheinbaum would give what my estimation is the perfect response. And so that's why she's still so popular. She's been doing an extraordinary job that even the bourgeois media has to admit. We see these headlines, you know, Bloomberg, no longer the ice woman, or she's so tough, you know, quoting Trump in the New York Times, that they know that she's really a force to be reckoned with. 85% popular support in the latest polls. It's really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is incredible. Are there any things, you know, obviously you've just been praising her and she deserves praise. Are there any things that you want to see her do better? Any things that you think she should be doing better?
I think especially when it comes to the bilateral relationship, the one community that gets marginalized and forgotten about is the migrant community. You know, one of the bargaining chips that Mexico has been to continue to apply really restrictive migration policies at its southern border at the behest of the United States. That is happening. One of the ways that she got out of this first tariff negotiation was by pledging a mobilization of 10,000 troops to Mexico's northern border with the U.S. And of course, that means a more difficult journey. They've been doing this thing called the carousel, is called here in Spanish, where basically they pick up people in the north of the country and move them back south in order for them to start all over again. And it's obviously a deterrent strategy, which doesn't work. People are fleeing. They're not migrating, right? We have to emphasize that. They continue to make the journeys. Although there are also some signs that these policies are dissuading people, both in Mexico and the United States, people feeling like maybe it's not worth it because I'm not even going to be able to make it. But obviously, you know, traveling through Mexico, there's this quote from an Amnesty International report, which they said that one of the migrants quoted them as saying, I would rather cross the Darien Gap five times than cross through Mexico, because here they're exposed to violence by both state and non-state actors. And it is really, really quite difficult for them to endure this. Even Mexican migrants inside the United States are also really, really suffering. Obviously, there's been a state strategy to this, you know, an emergency button on an app, you know, more kind of cracking down on the consulates to do a better job of defending and protecting Mexicans inside of the United States. But we know that there's a lot of people. There was this viral video of this migrant in a detention center, the Chrome International Detention Center in Florida, calling her out directly, right? Saying, Claudia, if this reaches you, please help us, right? We're incomunicados. We don't have access to lawyers. Nobody knows what's going on. We're basically all in this tiny detention center that's not meant to hold as many people as they are. So, you know, I think more needs to be done on that. You know, I think the asymmetry of the relationship makes it difficult for Mexico to be, you know, really press on this file, but I'll never stop mentioning it, especially if somebody asks me around this. It's like, we have to do a better job of defending migrants because, you know, we can't throw them under the bus just to save ourselves in the face of Trump's xenophobia and racism.
Right. Well, speaking of Sheinbaum, she recently accepted diplomatic credentials of the ambassador of the state of Palestine. So can you talk about her position on Palestine? Of course, not the last time you were on, but the time before that, we had a lot of fun making fun of this guy from Democratic Majority for Israel, who literally accused Sheinbaum of thanking Jesus for her victory, despite the fact that she's a Jew. And then it turns out her husband's name is Jesus. So that was a fun one. He deleted that tweet. But can you talk about Sheinbaum's position on Palestine?
Yeah. So just as a reminder, you know, if people didn't catch that last episode, we read out a letter that she wrote to La Jornada, which is a newspaper here in Mexico, basically saying, because of my values as a Jew, I cannot stand for what's happening against the Palestinian people. I mean, also, you know, talking in particular about children. So every time that she's made a public statement around Palestine and Palestinian people, it's always been in favor of their liberation. And it's quite interesting because, of course, yeah, she comes from a tiny religious ethnic minority here in Mexico. She's of Jewish descent. She always kind of talks more about, you know, having been raised Jewish. She's not really kind of a practicing religious, which is obviously very common in the Jewish community as well.
Yeah.
But it is really quite extraordinary in such a Catholic country, such a, if you're not Catholic, you're probably Christian when it comes to Mexico, right?
That's a Spanish language thing. I didn't realize. So like you guys say or Christian or Catholic, whereas here it's like Christian or Catholic or Protestant, Catholic or Evangelical. Yeah. Right. But Christian when is like means non-Catholic,
but still, right. You know, believing in Jesus, basically referring to evangelicals. But there's also a large presence of like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and stuff.
Right.
That.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so in all of her positions, he's always kind of been really firm about this. She comes from a very strong left-wing tradition. She was a red diaper baby. Her parents, were leftist activists and organizers. She always tells these stories about how she used to read and visit with political prisoners in the infamous Lecumberri prison here in Mexico City. She, in high school, was involved in these left-wing organizations that tried to build links between the countryside and the city. She was active in, you know, student mobilizations and then obviously translated into formal political activism, you know, in other political spaces, but obviously with López Obrador and Morena being head of government in Mexico City and also now president. But yeah, I mean, this picture that you put up on the screen, it really is. I honestly, as a Mexican, it moved me, you know, to see the representative, you know, the Palestine ambassador to Mexico in the presidential office wearing that beautiful outfit next to the president wearing her presidential sash, you know, receiving her official credentials, right? So for people who aren't familiar, right, ambassadors eventually have to present their credentials directly to the executive. So there's a whole ceremony. It's a day-long event where they kind of file in one after another, but they didn't skip Palestine, right? And it's because Mexico, under López Obrador, formally recognized Palestine as a state. And that's this is the kind of the follow-up to that, to have Mexico's first woman president, Jewish, standing next to the Palestinian ambassador is extraordinary in these moments in particular, right? I mean, in this moment where the Palestinian people are facing a genocide, where Israel is flagrantly violating its ceasefire, I do think Mexico could go further. Mexico has a pretty deep economic political relationship with Israel and can and should, as Colombia has, break all relationships with them. It would come at a cost. I mean, of course, right? But that when the face of a genocide, of course, that's what should happen. But at the very least, we have this, you know, this very public position right at the U.S.'s doorstep. We've seen what they've done to Mahmoud Khalil, to other, people who are in the United States and have even suddenly said something about this, you know, expelling them from the country, denying them their visa. And here you have the president of your neighboring country saying, I'm going to pose here alongside the ambassador because we recognize Palestine and we recognize their legitimate right to struggle as they are and as they continue to be. And then, of course, also sends a message to Mexican society to say that, you know, we're on the right side of history and we should continue to back this position despite the pressure, because of course there is. Of course there is, right? I mean, Mexico could take the route of Canada, which has, you know, always these kind of mealy-mouthed statements. No, you know, again, and even in the, I would say that Mexico's statement around the violation of the ceasefire could have been stronger, right? In the same way that Mexico should say, who's doing the bombing? It's Israel. Who's doing the killing? It's Israel, right? And in that sense, yes, it was good there was a statement, but again, it can and should go further. But that also depends on us kind of opening up the political room here in the country so that they can take that leap.
Right. We wanted to actually show you an image, a video of someone who was deported to El Salvador. But before we talk about this, can you kind of set the stage of what it is Trump is doing with Venezuela and El Salvador, the relationship between Trump and Maduro and Nayeli Bukele and who these kind of figures are?
We can start with Venezuela because, you know, it's interesting. At the beginning, it looked like there might have been kind of a diplomatic détente, right? Where the special envoy, Greno, goes and visits the first official actual visit to Miraflores, the presidential palace in Caracas. You know, they reach this agreement. Greno takes some of the U.S. citizens back with him. They agree that to receive some of these deportation flights. And it seemed like things were going in the right direction. But then the hardliners in Trump's coalition won. And so the Rubios, the Maria Elvira Salazar, all of these who wanted a hardline position against the government in Venezuela. And so then we saw basically a return to the maximum pressure strategy of Trump's first term, which Biden largely kept in place. I would say the only thing that Biden changed was the Chevron license, which Trump has now rescinded, ordering them to wind down operations. And so we're back to the maximum pressure strategy. Grenell, in an interview with the Epoch Times, said, no, Trump doesn't want regime change, but he's doing everything last time that he was implementing in order to achieve regime change in Venezuela. And so obviously Venezuela, because of the strained diplomatic relationship, said, we're not going to receive direct deportation flights from the U.S. anymore. And so one of the ways that Trump has kind of worked around this is securing a deal with Bukele, who seems intent on turning his country into the prison, the slave house of Latin America. And I use those kind of really strong language deliberately. He's built these mega prisons in his country, and they're meant to kind of respond to his own security strategy, which has been very popular, admittedly so, inside of El Salvador, but basically violating any kind of due process, human rights, civil rights that did exist, jailing anybody and everybody that is suspected of having any ties to organized crime or gangs, as they call them, in El Salvador. And now opening it up to basically renting it out so that people can who are being deported from the U.S. can now be jailed there. And that's precisely what happened. So the first group that got sent there, apparently in violation of a judicial injunction, were sent on a plane to El Salvador with a lot of fanfare. They released all kinds of really gross propaganda videos, just really denigrating human beings, you know, shaving them and you know, on camera. And, you know, there's reports also of the kind of striking them and insulting them and all the rest of it. So basically the treatment that they've been applying to Salvadorans who have been detained to these migrants, all based on this accusation that their ties to a gang that was born in Venezuela, but really kind of grew in terms of its influence inside of the United States, called Tren de Aragua. Now, the curious thing is that it turns out many of the people were identified by their tattoos or their shoes or just by their faces, by relatives who assure that they are not tied to organized crime or gangs at all. In fact, there was another plane. So now, because the U.S. doesn't send planes directly to Venezuela, what's been happening is they send them either to Mexico, and then from Mexico, they go to Venezuela. This last one came from Honduras. It's actually the second flight, if I'm not mistaken, coming from Honduras. And the interior minister of Venezuela, Diosdado Cabello, said none of them have any ties to Tren de Aragua. So it's just an effort to criminalize all migrants, to criminalize all Venezuelans in particular. And it's really tragic, ironic in a sense, because, you know, he, in his statement, in the actual text of the invocation of the Alien Enemies Act, he says that Venezuela deliberately sent them into the United States to sow unrest and all the rest of it. Also even accusing Maduro of being the Cartel de Sol. It's just this fantasy that they have. But if you look at a recent report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, they figured out, they pointed out that in cases of Cuba, Venezuela, what drives migration? Unilateral coercive measures, sanctions, the oil blockade of Venezuela, the blockade of Cuba. They're not being sent there. They are fleeing their countries that are undergoing hardship as a result of U.S. foreign policy. And now to turn that around and to say that they're actually being sent deliberately, it's so grotesque. And then to take them and throw them into a prison like this when many of them didn't have due process. I mean, just recently, I think it was yesterday, came out, the judge wants to know if his order was violated, which he has the right to do. That's what the judicial branch of government is meant to do. It'd be a check on the executive. They're now calling it a state secret. So first, all the fanfare, publishing videos everywhere, photos, celebrating. Oh, now it's a state secret. Now we can't say, because it might, it's absolutely patently absurd. And it's all part of this agenda. It's a racist, xenophobic agenda to really tar all migrants. And one final note on this, because it's really quite tragic as well. So a lot of something around 550,000 Haitians, Cubans, Venezuelans, they accepted what's called the parole program in the U.S. So it's not like parole in prisons. It's just the term they use. So basically, if they had a sponsorship, a community, a family member who was willing to take them in, they would have a 2-year permission to be inside of the United States while they look for other kinds of either asylum or permanent residency or another work visa, whatever it was. Those have been rescinded. And they've been told to leave by, sometime in April. So, I thought Trump said he was only going to kick out the criminal elements, right? But because of this effort to try all Venezuelans, to drain that agua, people are believing this. Like, oh, no, they're all illegals. They're all criminals. They all should go. But they all obeyed the rules. That some of the people who were sent to El Salvador presented themselves at their CBP-1 appointments, and now they're in languishing in a prison in Central America, which has a lot about Bukele as well in terms of the lengths he's willing to go to appease Trump. He obviously really wants to be in favor with him because he's got his own authoritarian regime that he's trying to cultivate there, obviously perpetuating himself in power, despite the fact that El Salvador doesn't permit re-election, but yet there he is.
Yeah, let's show a video because you just mentioned these disgusting, what do you call them? Like slavery?
Slave house. Yeah. It's like a prison house of Latin America.
Yeah, it's disgusting. So we have an image of a video. I don't actually know who made this. I assume it's someone from the Trump administration. It's a disgusting, disgusting video. And the title of it on Twitter from the Breaking 911 Twitter account, I honestly don't know about them. Is watch Venezuelan gang members supported by Trump arrive at mega prison El Salvador. I have no idea if this is what they're calling it, but regardless of who they are or whether or not they're guilty, I just want to show this. It's a disgusting thing and it's very humiliating, but it's important to watch. Let's take a look at it.
Be clear, what you just sent me was not posted by the White House, but either this or something basically exactly like it has been something that literally the White House has posted online.
Right.
And I just, sorry to interject one more time. I just wanted to point out to people that it might not be something that they're familiar with when you're watching this, from a filming perspective, this was like highly produced. This took a lot of money and a lot of preparation to produce this. It's all very deliberate. Yeah.
Yeah. Here it is.
Like that's a dolly shot.
A dolly, right? Yeah, it's like really scary. Also, the way they're masked, the police or the officers or soldiers, whatever.
And then just this, all of this from their body positioning to what they're doing to them here—it just ultimately dehumanizing.
Yeah, it's really awful.
So, just checking. I'm pretty sure that video was made by the Salvadorian government. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because it was posted by Nayib Bukele.
Okay. Well, yeah.
It would explain its high production value. That's what they do. It's part of his strategy is to precisely kind of parade these images around the world saying, look how tough we are on the, on the gangs. When, I read this one report where somebody, because they had a Real Madrid tattoo, they're like, that's a gang tattoo. And that's why they were picked up.
It's a football soccer team.
Yeah, I read recently, I don't know if it was that person or another person who was grabbed, got a sworn affidavit from their tattoo artist basically saying, that's not what that is. It's just unbelievable.
People are saying, oh, this is great. Bukele is really helping make El Salvador a safer place. What's your response to that?
I mean, his policies have certainly impacted the level of crime that's happening inside of El Salvador, and it explains why he is so popular. But of course, it's something that is effective in a country like El Salvador. It's a very, very small country. It's one of the smallest countries in the world. With a very limited population, in fact, here in Mexico, there was a debate happening where he criticized Mexico in its security policy with a really kind of absurd argument. He basically said, he's like, Mexico is made up of states just the way that the United States is. And he's like, something like 29 of them actually have a smaller population than El Salvador. Why don't they just do state by state and reduce crime that way, the way that we've done it? I don't understand this argument that only we could do it here. It's, of course, absurd, right? Like, in a territory like Mexico, organized crime groups don't respect state boundaries, and that strategy would not work. But even if we were to apply it, we're talking about jailing millions upon millions of Mexicans in equivalent in terms of population for that to work. It only works there because of the small population can actually, you can conceivably jail enough people to actually bring crime down. But there's no attention to the root causes. Right. There's no concern about the future of young people. What are the economic prospects for a country like El Salvador with the reputation that it is now earning throughout the world? What's going to happen when, you know, the kids who are 14, 15, 16 years old grow up and there's no jobs for them? Is that the future that waits for them? Just another, you know, bunk in one of these mega prisons that he's building? And it's actually an economic policy for him, too, because he's charging the U.S. to house these migrants. You know, he said for a period of a year, you know, and on that same point, right? Like, you know, they asked Rubio, well, you know, we've heard reports that a lot of the people who have been sent have no criminal records whatsoever. He's like, well, if it turns out they don't, El Salvador can just deport them to Venezuela then, right? Like, just, you know, we're going to wash our hands of it. And I've been reading this, this analyst, and he's basically been really insisting on this point. I forget his last name, Aaron Melchick. I think is his name. I apologize. But he's been really driving this point home, which is just like, there is no law anywhere in the U.S. books that allows them to do what they did to these Venezuelan migrants to send them to El Salvador. There's no actual way to justify it. No, there's no subsection that allows you to take somebody who is an asylum seeker and to ship them to a different country. And yet they do it. Right. And they refuse to explain whether or not this policy was, you know, in violation of this judge's order. And then just yesterday, now they want, because they're not allowed to deport or expel people according to this order by a federal judge, now they're extraditing them as a way of working around it. So it shows just how aggressive they are. They'll do anything to continue with this policy. That's a really important alarm bell to sound, because if they do it to them, they'll do it to everybody. That's the point, right? Like, they want to see how far they can get. And then that part means, you know, maybe they'll start, or as they already have, going after green card holders. There's even talk about them sending U.S. citizens to El Salvador. If they can get away with it, they will do it.
Yeah, I mean, historically, it's, you know, people, they always go after the most like marginalized, precarious people, and then they apply it to the less marginalized people. Not that it's okay. I mean, we shouldn't only oppose it in case it happens to us, whoever the us is. But that is true. Something to bear in mind. There's one more video I wanted to show of Mike Waltz being interviewed by Margaret Brennan. Asked about the way that they are attempting to justify, legally speaking, what they're doing to Venezuelans, who are not, by the way, always Venezuelan. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for joining. That was a great show. I love the variety. And I just also want to say that I mentioned this earlier. It is beyond infuriating and tragic and a war crime, the targeting of journalists. And very recently, I just want to say their names, and these are only two of them, only two of the many killed journalists who have been targeted. This is not like in the fog of war. They're intentionally killed. So those two journalists' names are Mohammed Mansour and Hassam Shabbat were killed by Israel March 24th. 124 journalists were killed around the world in 2024. Around two-thirds of them were Palestinian. And I wanted to read part of this message from Hassam Shabbat, which his team released after he was killed. It's really, I mean, it's awful, but I do want to read it. This is Hassam's team, and we are sharing his final message. If you're reading this, it means I have been killed, most likely targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. When this all began, I was only 21 years old, a college student with dreams. Like anyone else, for past 18 months, I've dedicated every moment of my life to my people. I documented the horrors in northern Gaza minute by minute, determined to show the world the truth they tried to bury. I slept on pavements, in schools, in tents, anywhere I could. Each day was a battle for survival. I endured hunger for months, yet I never left my people's side. By God, I fulfilled my duty as a journalist. I risked everything to report the truth, and now I'm finally at rest. something I haven't known in the past 18 months. I did all this because I believe in the Palestinian cause. I believe this land is ours, and it has been the highest honor of my life to die defending it and serving its people. I ask you now, do not stop speaking about Gaza. Do not let the world look away. Keep fighting. Keep telling our stories until Palestine is free. Okay, so that is just one of the hundreds of journalists killed by Israel on purpose in a targeted assassination. All right. Okay. Sorry to leave on that note, but also I want to wanted to make sure that we do hear his that message and his message to not stop talking about it. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.